Good morning and welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates, your host. It is Monday, October 21st. Time to kick off a great week on Faith and Family. Come on, every week is a great week here on Faith and Family, right? This week, how do you celebrate, how do you learn about and celebrate the Reformation with your family? We've got some great guests lined up for this week to help us celebrate the Reformation and our Lutheran heritage. Who are some of the significant Lutherans in our past, in our history, in our heritage? What happened with those families? And what can we learn from them? And how can we learn about them? So we're going to talk with some great guests. Today, we're going to talk with Linda Lorenz, curator at Saxon Lutheran Memorial down in Frohna, Missouri. So we're going to talk with her in just a little bit about all the opportunities there for learning about Lutheran heritage, Lutherans who came and settled here in the United States early on, and what happened with their families, and lots of great stuff, and what your family can do to learn about the Reformation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so today. 314-821-0850 in the St. Louis area. Outside of St. Louis, 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email your questions and comments to family@kfuo.org. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. If you'd like to find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go visit our website, kfuo.org. Go to the sponsor section, look for the CUW logo. That'll take you to their website. Just click on that CUW logo. You can go to Concordia University, Wisconsin's website and find out all about the great programs that they have to offer. And check it out. I encourage you to do that. Go to kfuo.org. Well, joining us by phone today is Linda Lorenz, curator at Saxon Lutheran Memorial. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great. How are things down in Frohna? It's getting a little bit quieter down there, I guess, huh?
It is a lot quieter.
Well...
But it's going good, still steady.
Good, good. I know there is so much history packed into Saxon Lutheran Memorial. Let's start with first off with you and what your path, what path you took to end up at Saxon Lutheran Memorial. And then we'll get into the history behind Saxon Lutheran Memorial as well.
Well, hopefully we'll have time.
Sure, we can pack it all in.
No. Actually, I've worked in the church field for 25 years now. I started out with Lutheran Hour Ministries and then moved over to the Synodical Headquarters and worked there for 10 years. And 6 years ago, my husband and I took this position on, and it was the hand of God that brought us here. It was a part of a conversation between my husband and another gentleman, and with a kind of a slight hint and suggestion that this might be a good job for him, and he said no, it would be great for my wife. And long story short of it is, a couple of days after that conversation, I received a phone call saying that they had heard I wanted to be the curator, and I was like, oh, that's very interesting. So we thought and prayed about it. That was in March, and by July we had moved down, and I started August 1st in 2007. What kept us here, though, is As a child, my parents moved to Frohna, so I was familiar with Frohna, had lived here. And then my husband Doyle is from the Far area, and so he is a native. And since being here, we've also found out that his family, the Lawrence family, was members of the Gruber group that came and settled what was Peitsdorf and is now Uniontown. So he has some personal history here that we did not know about beforehand but have since learned, and that's been made the job much more personal then.
So the personal connection to the place where you get to serve and not just serve, but you live there too.
Yes, we do.
Right there. So you get to live at work. I bet your commute is really long.
Oh, it all depends on how often I want to walk across the road.
Well,
no, it is. It's very nice to be this close.
Tell us, where is Saxon Lutheran Memorial located? I know, we have listeners all around the world, but tell us, give us an idea of, you're in Southeast Missouri.
Southeast Missouri would be very broad, and then you could narrow it down by saying we're 100 miles south of St. Louis. For those who are in closer areas, we're basically sandwiched between Cape Girardeau. We're north of Cape Girardeau, south of Perryville, and then scoot over towards the river a little bit. So that gets us, gets you in a real general vicinity of, if you look at the state of Missouri as it makes its way down the Mississippi, where the the little bump that kind of juts out into the river before you get to Cape.
Not too far from, you know, a day's drive from, not even a day's drive from St. Louis, but from other cities.
An hour and a half from St. Louis, so very doable.
But from other cities as well, could be a weekend road trip. And we'll get into that here in a little bit, what families can do at Saxon Lutheran Memorial. Some might call it a museum, a historic site. What is Saxon Lutheran Memorial?
It is actually a homestead and a farmstead. And its history dates back to even before the Saxons arrived here. So it was a settlement that was already set up and established, a working farm. And two brothers from the Saxon immigration, Wilhelm and Christian Berecht, came upon it. And I don't have any more clear information or statistics on that or history on that other than they came upon it, found it. It was something that they were interested in, and they purchased it. So this here has been operating as a farm since 1820. And so it's a log cabins. There's a log-structured barn. And we also have two slave cabins on site that were part of Mr. Twyman, who is the original settler, that was part of his operation of his farmstead.
So it was a farmstead that was owned by someone else, and then the Saxon Lutherans who came into the area came upon it and acquired it.
Right, right. Now, the best we can figure, without having, you know, that written history that was passed down, is that most likely the Twyman or the Berecht brothers had enough money from either the sale of their business and their homes in Germany that they could pay for their voyage to America and with the immigration, and still kept their own money and did not put everything they owned into the common treasury. Otherwise, I don't know how they would have had the money to make the purchase that they did of this farm, which was a 200-acre farm.
Wow. So the Berecht brothers acquired it, and it became their homestead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there were three generations that lived here of the Berecht family. So over the span of 117 years, it belonged to the Berechts. And the last member of the family that lived here passed away in 1956. And so she was 80 years old, and her name was Lina. And she was born here, and she was raised here. To my knowledge, she had always been here, and she never married. So she did not venture very far away from here or move out on her own. This was home for her.
And when
the last time that somebody lived here as a Berecht family member, while it was still somebody's residence, was in 1956.
And how long after that then did it become a part of Concordia Historical Institute and in a place, a memorial?
It was purchased at a sale by some local farmers who were cousins, I believe, and brothers, and they ran it for 5 years as just a farm. Nobody ever lived here again. And then in 1961, so 5 years later, then Concordia Historical Institute became the new owners. And it took them 3 years to get it into a presentable condition for the public, because it had gotten quite run down and pretty dilapidated over the years. And it took them 3 years to get it into a condition that they could present it to the public. And so it was officially opened then to the public with a dedication service. I want to say it was on Reformation, actually, in 1964.
And what was on the property at that time? It's a farmstead, but what was there at that time, and what's since been added?
Very simply, it was a double cabin, and the best way to describe that is if you would think of a current-day duplex with two cabins side by side connected by their chimney, of their fireplaces backed up to each other. And so that was the connecting factor for that. So there were two side-by-side log cabins. There were the two small slave cabins, a granary, and a log barn. And then later the Berecht had built a frame structure around the barn. So it's a very nice-sized barn. And that is what was part of the initial purchase. So a barn, a granary, two log cabins that were homes, and then two slave cabins that were later used as storage and chicken coop by the barracks. And that's what CHI purchased, along with 11 acres initially. Over the years, many things have been added here to know where now we have 15 buildings, a variety of uses that and purposes that they serve, and they also added another 19 acres. So we actually have a total of 30 acres now that gives us lots of room to spread out, gives us a lot more opportunity to have events and to host special occasions and to conduct our festivals.
So now you've got a great site, a great facility for teaching and learning a lot about history.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to talk more about the Burke family, you know about the Burke family.
Well, I know they were a very generous family. I know they were a pillar of the community early on. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that during those early days and months of Walther, CFW Walther's time in East Perry County, he became ill. And one of the things that the barracks did to help that process along is they offered to have the Frona congregation worship in their home. And the reason for that is that Walther's sister was married to Pastor Kyle, who was the pastor of Frona at the time. And they were still having church services in the pastor's home. Frona did not have their first church building until 5 years later in 1844. And so while Walther recuperated at his sister's home, they could not have church services. And the barracks offered to have those services in their home here. So it has served as a place of worship in those early beginning months of getting settled as an establishment. Later on, when Pastor Kyle took a call out of the area, and they called their second pastor, which was Reverend Labor, who was a young candidate out of the Altenburg Seminary. He was the son of the senior pastor Labor in Trinity, who was their first pastor. They called him to be the teacher and the pastor of Concordia. And while they were preparing his home, the barracks again opened their home and let him rent out the attic for a couple of years. So then he conducted school here also. So now the buildings have served as not only a home, but a worship place and a teaching place as a school for the time being. Like I said, they seem to be very involved with their community. One of the Barrack brothers, Wilhelm, the older of the two, his wife unfortunately had passed away after being married for 3 years, and it is my understanding that Walther was very instrumental in encouraging him to go into the ministry, and he did. And that was actually about the same time that they were moving the seminary from Altenburg to St. Louis, so he actually attended seminary and maybe was even one of the first class members as it was established in St. Louis. And so he went on to be a pastor and ended his ministry career in Nebraska. Kristen, the younger of the two, stayed on here and remained as a farmer. Now, they were both weavers in Germany, but once they arrived here in America, they knew how important it was and what an impact it would be for them to have a farm ready to go with fields already plowed and worked and planted, and that they had a food source that would be so beneficial to many, many people that they immediately assigned themselves the new task of being farmers instead of weavers. And that's all you ever see Christian Barrack listed at in the census records is a farmer, even as early as 1840, right after they arrived.
And let's go back a little bit in history. And I know we're going to talk with our friends at the Lutheran Heritage Center and the museum on Wednesday, but what prompted the Barrack family and other Saxons to move to Perry County?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. One primarily being the religious aspect of it, and that they felt that their faith and their worship was being compromised by the government of Germany. And that was a big driving force. Secondly, I believe it was economical as well for some, because at that time, industrialization was starting to become a larger presence in business and in their area. And so for these folks who lived in small villages and had cottage industries as being the tailor and the sausage maker and the shoemaker and the blacksmith and things like that, it was kind of edging them out a little bit. And so it was also an economic decision, but I think foremost was the religious aspect of it. It was went against their conscience to compromise their faith and their practices in their church because the government was telling them differently. And so they felt they were being persecuted in their faith and felt it necessary to leave. And so that is a good reason, two main reasons why. Now, there may have been other reasons, beyond that, but those are the two that you'll hear most about.
Any indication as to why Perry County? There were other Lutherans who settled in other parts of the U.S. and in North America. Why? Any indication what was the draw to Perry County?
I think a big, well, again, two. I mean, there's never just one answer, I don't think. I've personally never been to Germany, but we from time to time get a number of people here who visit America who want to see what a little German town looks like. We've also had quite a number of people in our area who have gone back to trace their roots, and I would say the topography and the lay of the land was a good draw because it reminded them of home. And, they've already made so many sacrifices and gone through quite a lengthy hardship to get here, that to find a place that was going to be comfortable to them because their surroundings were familiar, I think was very important to them. And so the rolling hills, and we have lots of woods and not really forests, but heavily wooded areas, and several creeks and streams, and we're right along the river. And so I think this reminded them, as much about home as they could. Secondly, Martin Stefan, who was their leader, was a bit of a controlling leader, and that might even be putting it kindly for those who know that history even more.
Sure we'll talk about it even more on Wednesday.
Yes,
definitely.
I believe so. We'll let that be the lead-in for there. But in his efforts to keep his quote-unquote people together, he wanted to find a place that was more isolated and might even present a bit of a hardship for people to get back to a bigger city. He felt that if he was in a bigger city, he would, again, quote-unquote, lose his people that they would scatter. And so in an effort to keep everyone together, he went to find a place that was isolated enough that it was not easy for them to get to a city. But to his credit, and I honestly believe in giving people due credit where it's, necessary, he also wanted to establish an identity. And even 175 years later, when people are looking for a small German Lutheran community in southeast Missouri, it is inevitable that they point to, well, you have to go over to East Perry County. So even, that long ago, that identity still exists. And, nowadays, by those who live here and have been brought up here and have their roots here, they would. You may hear some say, well, it's getting watered down. And I can see that to some degree because not everybody is as connected as they used to be. But even so, beyond that, that is the description that you will get of this area, is that it is a small German Lutheran village or town. And that's what they wanted from the very beginning.
And if we think an hour and a half drive from St. Louis is a long trip now, imagine back then how remote that must have been, how
oh,
far outside. Because as I understand it, they traveled to St. Louis first and then moved out to Perry County after that.
Well, I think something that people don't realize, and part of when I give a tour here, I like to paint the picture, and it takes just a little bit of extra time, but I think it helps keep the proper perspective on why what we have in this area at our site, at the Altenburg Museum, at any of the churches that are here, why that is so important. because it wasn't just, oh, they moved from one country to the next. It was, it took them everything they had, and they traveled for 6 months before they ever landed on the banks of Wittenberg and said, we're home. And then you look around, and all you see is a river bluff and maybe a path. So what does that mean to say I'm home? But they were, because there was no turning back. Now, it's not to say that a few of them didn't make it back to Germany, but for the most part, because almost everybody gave what they had to make the journey, they had no option but to make this their home. And so it's more than just a hardship, and I don't think any one of us today could even imagine wholeheartedly what it was like to bounce across the ocean in the bottom of a boat for 4 to 6 weeks and then travel for a month up the Mississippi in a steamboat during the middle of the winter, and then stay in St. Louis for 3 months in glorified cardboard boxes, basically, because there's still no running water or heat or central heat or anything like that. It's still, you know, shanties, basically, that they crowded 3 and 4 families into in order to make it do until they knew they could come down here. So you board another riverboat, and like I said, you get to the bank of the Mississippi, and that's all you have at the moment.
It certainly was a danger-fraught journey, without a doubt. I want to talk more about that. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back from the break, I want to talk more about that. And our listener, Jan, has a good question as well about some of the buildings on the property that you mentioned earlier. So we'll talk about that when we come back from our break. Stick around for more right here on Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
I often say small acts of kindness mean a great deal to those who receive them. Here's a case in point. Ashley England took her two sons, grandparent and great-grandparent, out to eat in North Carolina. Her son Riley suffers from epilepsy and is nonverbal. His hunger and frustration caused him to act out with verbal screams and fits. It was a tough time for Mom. A teary-eyed waitress came to their table and handed Ashley a note from an anonymous customer who paid for their meal. The note read, "God only gives special children to special people." Ashley cried, saying, "He doesn't know how much it was needed." But God did, and He sent relief in the form of a caring person. I ask you to do the same if given the chance. Be an ambassador for Christ.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Retirement, a college education, buying a home, the big decisions in life require a great deal of thought and discussion. That's why nearly 2.5 million members turn to Thrivent Financial for Lutherans for financial advice. We'll develop a financial strategy to help you reach your goals, and we'll provide advice to keep your financial program on track with your dreams. To find a Thrivent Financial representative, call 314-783-4200.
Registered representatives for securities offered through Thrivent Investment Management Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
Pope Francis has delivered his first message in English, a greeting to Catholics attending an evangelization conference in the Philippines.
I hope you would experience again the loving presence of Jesus in your lives, that you would love the church.
The Argentine pontiff, whose father was Italian, has delivered most of his messages in Italian since being elected pope. On Friday, he told the Philippine conferees that every aspect of life needs the message of Jesus.
Let Jesus speak now in the world of politics, business, arts, science, technology, and social media.
Francis also asked for prayer.
Please, pray for me. I need it.
On Sunday, the Pope reverted to Italian as he urged pilgrims in St. Peter's Square to join him in praying for the people of the Philippines, where an earthquake last Tuesday killed at least 171 people. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. This week, we are talking about Lutheran heritage and the Reformation, how your family can learn about it and celebrate our Lutheran heritage and the Reformation. And before we went to break, we were talking with Linda Lorenz, curator at Saxon Lutheran Memorial in Frohna, Missouri. And Linda, before we went to break, we were talking about the dangerous journey that the families, the Saxons, took to come to the United States to make a new home here, and a very dangerous journey, as you were pointing out, traveling in the bottom of a boat, and then on a steamboat up to St. Louis, and then staying in St. Louis in basically, like you said, a glorified cardboard box through the winter, and then moving to a remote area without many resources around.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. I mean, it's quite miraculous that they, as many of them, survived through all of it. But it was their fortitude and determination that really kept them putting, looking forward and staying focused. But more than that, it was pure faith. And my goodness, I think about this so many times because I share the story over and over and over. So it's a good constant reminder to me. I mean, what could we do if we all had faith that strong that kept putting one foot in front of the other, even though you did not know anything what was ahead of you and facing you?
A question from our listener, Jan.
Mm-hmm.
When you were talking about the properties earlier, I'm sure this caught a few ears or many ears. You mentioned some of the buildings on the property, two of which you mentioned were slave cabins.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the story behind that. I'm sure that catches a lot of ears today.
Well, the Twyman family, who we believe is from the Braslaw settlement and community, which was Scotch-Irish and Presbyterian core of their community, they moved away, and Braslaw is just 3 miles north of us, so not very far, and that was slavery in this area was very common. And our understanding is that when Mr. and Mrs. Twyman were married, that was a gift to them from her parents. And so their family, the slave family, also grew. It was a mother and father and 7 children. And they lived, like I said, quite a distance away from the original cabins where their dwellings were built and made in the woods there. And so with this being a huge farm, it was beneficial to Mr. Twyman to have the extra help. It was beneficial to the slave family to have an opportunity to work and have a living and have food and shelter. This was before Missouri was a state, and so they were helpful to one another. Now, I say that, but I don't want anyone to feel that I'm slighting or making light of the issue of slavery. That is not it at all. It's just in this area, for many instances, they were very helpful to each other, and to the point that I know in the Presbyterian Church in Braslaw, they worshiped together. The back pews of the church were saved for those that had slave families and on their property so that they could worship together. So it was a very, I don't want to say good, but for their circumstances, it was a good arrangement and good situation that each could help each other. But like I said, there were bigger farms and quite a few slaves in the area. It's just that for this family, it was a one-on-one situation where they helped each other out. The Twymans, when they moved, the slave families went with them. And so, I mean, it was just one family, but they went with them. The Saxons, as a whole and as the Berk brothers individually, and nobody had ever owned slaves. That was against their belief of ownership of individuals and ownership of people was not what they believed was right. And so nobody from the immigration had slaves on their property. But we do still have those cabins here. At some point in time, the Berks moved them from the woods to closer to the home, and so they rest right directly across the road from the cabins. And like I said, one was probably used for storage, and we do have proof in photos that one of the other cabins was used as a chicken coop. And so true to their nature is Germans are very frugal and very creative in reusing things. They did not want to see these buildings go to waste. And I can only imagine that once they arrived here with having the structures that they did on this property, that it also was a lifesaver for many of those who they could, as many as people they could help, because it was a solid structure that somebody could stay in until they had their own place to live and had their own cabins built.
It provided a means of hospitality.
Right, right. And, you know, and that, like I said, that's something that goes along with how we have, what we have learned of the Berks and how they interacted with their community, that I don't think they would have let them set just empty like that, that they would have definitely offered it as shelter along with the granary. Now, whether that had grain in it or not, we have no record of it, but if it were empty, I know for a fact it would have been used as shelter, and we know that they did let people stay in the barn, so they were very, very giving of what they had.
What was, well, I want to get to that question in a second. I want to remind our listeners, if they want to, if they have a question as well, they can call with a question or email with a question. They can call 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727, or you can email family@kfuo.org with your question for today about Saxon Lutheran Memorial. What was family life on the farmstead like for the Berkt family?
Well, being the fact that they became farmers, and they had quite a bit of acreage that was already plowed and worked up into fields, I'm sure it was very hard. I don't know that they came prepared with tools, so it would be a matter of finding a place or sharing tools. Maybe they did, you know, just kind of assume that they would need something and brought them with them from St. Louis. At that time, obviously, you farmed with horses or mules or oxen, and so they would have had to find a way or in a place or somebody that they could purchase the animals from. A typical farmstead would have had, for a family's survival, you would have your work animals, your horses or oxen or mule. You would have a family cow that you could get your milk from, and then you would probably have a pig or two, a flock of chickens. You would definitely have a garden, and probably a good size one at that. And then you would have had to have learned, and that's where the people from Brazos really became so vital to this community, this new community that was coming in, is that they brought with them not only the resources of tools and help, but knowledge of where to go to find these things that they needed, who had animals that could be purchased, where, what kind of food was in the woods that they could readily access, like berries and nuts and you know, greens and things like that. What animals were good to eat and weren't, that, you know, that you would be able to find readily, turkey and deer and rabbit and squirrels. These are all brand new things to the Saxons as they arrived here. Even down to what plants to avoid, such as poison ivy. So those were things that they were encountering for the first time. So a farmstead, you needed to know these things, where you could go to get the tools and resources. And so, and like I said, I'm guessing that within a few years that they extended the barn and added to it so that they had larger room to store hay, to put more animals in, and to make use of. So it was certainly by no means an easy life. You would grow sorghum so that you could squeeze it out and cook it down to make molasses. That was your sugar. You would find apples and press apples, because then that you could make it into vinegar, and that was a food preservative. And that was another thing that I think was a huge, huge change for them when they got here, is when they lived in Germany, you have to understand, those towns were over 400 years old, and so you had a lot of things in place that you, like we do today, kind of take advantage of, or take for granted, not advantage of, but you become very used to. You know what you have, and you know what's there. And for them to leave villages that have been established for hundreds of years already, and to live in stone or brick homes that are 2 and 3 stories with cellars that have food storage so that you know how to preserve your food, to come here and not have any of that available, and to have to build a log cabin that becomes your home instead of bricks and stones, this was very, very difficult for them. So the fact that the barracks had a place that already had a cabin, like I said, gave them just a huge blessing and advantage that they could share and offer. So gardens, fruits, nuts, your animals, all very, very important. And then knowing what you needed and having that knowledge of how to use it and knowing what to do, planting corn and have it, which provided food for family and animals. All very important things to know, but since not very many of them were farmers who came over, these were all things they had to learn as well.
Basically, a pretty big vocational change for them when it came to day-to-day life.
Yes, very much so. I mean, think about it. You had to chop wood. I mean, that was essential because you needed fire. Fire provided heat, a means to heat water and heat for the home, for the blacksmith to run his forge, and so firewood. Now, wood was certainly all around them, so that was easy, but we're talking forest and woods that have never been harvested. They had some very, very large, gigantuous trees here. And so this, again, is not a task they're used to doing, and it's dangerous enough to fell trees that are half that size, much less the size of trees that we see evidence of in the logs that are put on, that these cabins are built with.
How about children? What did they do on the farmstead?
Oh, they work right alongside the parents, shelling corn, picking corn, churning the butter, helping with the laundry, gathering kindling, gathering the eggs, feeding the chickens, taking care of the animals, helping in the garden. It certainly wasn't anything close to the life our kids lead today. there was no extracurricular sports. You went to school where they had school. And, it was not a requirement to finish school for many young boys. If they made it to 6th grade, 8th grade, that was as much school as they felt they needed. And so then you went to work on the farm, or you were an apprentice for a trade that you would go into as a business. So there were lots of things that kids did. And jobs were also divided a lot more than they are. Girls had girl jobs and boys had boys jobs. Girls learned to do the handwork and the knitting and the embroidery and lace making. They tended the gardens and took care of the small animals and the chickens. The guys worked in the fields and worked with the big animals and made sure the crops came in, and the wood handling and things like that. So there were a lot of very definitive jobs for each one.
And you mentioned school. What about faith life? What about catechesis or instruction? Was that a part of school and worship?
Well, the part I can tell you about worship, and it stands out to me the most, and I'm sure there are many, many more stories than just this one that I know, but it's a pure example of, again, the strength of their faith and determination that their worship was their hub of their community, no matter what the circumstances were. And again, going back to that situation when Walther was ill, those folks could have easily said, well, we'll worship once a month to make it easier on the pastor. He's already taxed. Or we'll go to other congregations until CFW is well and we can have our pastor back. But Pastor Kyle and the members of the community here who started the Concordia Church on a weekly met and opened their home so that they could continue their worship. I know they worshipped on the way over on the ships. They did not take that as a break. That was weekly worship. They even had communion sets on each ship so that they could continue in that with that practice as well. So I really think it was the root and the foundation of what they stood on and for everything that they did. For a long time, the church was the disciplinary voice of the communities. And so it was, you know, you just didn't, your whole functioning revolved around your church life and activities and the rule and authority of it.
Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure that folks, that our listeners know what, obviously we've shared a lot of, a good picture of the history for the Berg family and the farmstead there, but there's so much more to just hearing about it.
Oh, absolutely. It makes such a huge difference, and we're always so pleased and so happy. The whole area, not just our site, but the between the two museums, to be able to tell that story one-on-one and or to large groups or school children or anyone who wants, you know, who comes, takes the time to make a visit to the area, to be able to share with them so they can see and put their hands on it. And that's one of the things. I think what's very unique about how we present this, because I know there's lots of towns around the whole United States that are have similar beginnings of immigrants coming and starting from nothing and building their way up. But one of the unique things about how our history is presented here is at the Altenburg Museum, you get a very good sense of strong regional history that shares and is not confined to a time frame. And so you can see the process and the progress of the history there. And then as you come to the Sachs Memorial, you kind of take and bring that to a real narrow focus, and now we have an actual homestead that people lived in that are original to the site, and it gives you a picture of that lifestyle. And where we can and when we can, we allow people to touch and handle and feel and try the tools and the task that were done here. So we have corn shellers and corn grinders at the barn that a lot of kids enjoy doing and taking to feed the corn over to the chickens and being able to feed the chickens. Sometimes our mule is in the barn and we let them you know, feed them some hay and some oats. They get to go in and gather the eggs. When they come, we have an outdoor brick oven. And so whether it's adult groups or kid groups, we try to do some baking so that they can get a sense of what it was like to cook as a pioneer. So there's lots of things that we will let people put their hands on and actually get to see and do while they're here, because I just think that you learn by doing, and that's real important, because kids and you know, I say kids a lot because we work with a lot of students, but as a rule, most people aren't going to remember names and dates. But they will remember what they got to do, and they will remember that they ate pizza baked in a brick oven.
That smells so good.
And it does. or that they, you know, got to see something that grandma and grandpa used. And so it churns up memories.
Mm-hmm.
It helps people to connect to their family. For those who are blessed and fortunate enough to have the grandparents, we always encourage them to go back and ask questions. I can't tell you how many times people will say, when I was young, I didn't really think about it, and it didn't matter, and I wish now I would have asked Grandma and Grandpa more questions. So do that. You know, we really want people to do that, because there will come a time that what we're doing today will be a relic or an antique, and we'll have history to it, and you'll want to pass that along. And so it's real important to keep that oral history going and be able to make the connection now with the things of the past so that you can keep the connection with those going forward in the future.
There, you're right. There's so much history there, and we learn and retain so much more when we use all of our senses.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to use your hands and as you said, to with the corn and to do some baking. And I know from my childhood, smells always trigger memories.
Oh gosh, yes.
You know, so many smells. So just walking in some of those some of the cabins,
mm-hmm.
and the smells of the old wood and those types of things, I think can go in as a child, and it'll still trigger memories when you smell that later on, years
sure.
later. So
or the barn and smelling the hay. And
right.
You know, and the typical barn smells, you know.
Yes.
Some of them are repulsive to some people, but then some say, oh, my goodness, I remember having to clean the stalls, and they go into wonderful stories. And I learn as much from the visitors who come here who have experienced it firsthand as children or with their grandparents. And so it goes both ways, that the story sharing and the history. But we have a fairly, I would say, a pretty good educational program here that we have established for school kids when they come here on field trips. We set up stations for them to follow through. And so in the springtime, they'll get to go to the garden, and we teach them about where the food comes from. It's very important, not just for now where our food comes from, but the gardening is a hobby for most of us. As a pioneer, it was your livelihood, and you had to plant and plan and prepare and store enough food to get you through the winter, because you didn't have Walmart to go to or the grocery store to go to when the frost hit. And so you had to have enough, and it was your grocery store. And so we let kids plant potatoes and corn and beans, and we invite them to come back and harvest their foods that they planted. Some have. We've not had a lot of, but some have. They get to sample herbs because herbs were for their medicine and for healing and for personal hygiene. So they learn about that. They get to wash clothes on a washboard. They get to beat a rug. They get to bake in an oven. Then they learn about the history, and then we take them to the barn, and they learn what a schnitzelbank is and how to use a draw knife and how to feed animals and take care of animals. We always have a milk cow here, and depending on the time of the day and how soon the kids are here, sometimes they've even gotten to help milk the cow. So it's more farm-oriented, but that's what this was, and that's how you had to, what you had to do in order to survive.
And not just school trips, but if a family wants to pack up and make it a road trip and visit, they can certainly do that too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Whatever we categorize ourselves as a working farm. We're not truly a living history farm because we don't have someone here staged doing certain things all through the day that show that is a living example. My husband and I, like I said, we live here. So if we're out in the garden working, or if he's working with the animals, we call it a working farm because we have the animals, we have the garden, and we try to be able to show people what it was like back then by what we do today. And so it is available for whoever comes, whether it's just a family that wants to go on a day trip, a school trip who wants to take a field trip. Yesterday we had a group of several families, about 26 people from the seminary, come down, and that was absolutely wonderful. We just love it when they come down, and they had families along. So it can be a church group. It could be a youth group. We can set up servant events. There's so many things that we can do. We want this to be a purposeful site, mm-hmm. that people can find a way to enjoy the history by making it useful. I don't want it to become a building cemetery where people just drive through and say, look at those cool old buildings, mm-hmm. and that's it, because there's more to it than that. Those buildings have stories, and they have a life of their own that they can teach and be an outdoor classroom.
So if we show up and you're in the garden pulling weeds, then we get to pull weeds too.
Please do.
If you're in the stables, if you're in the barn, then we should grab a shovel too, huh?
Oh, most likely. If you come dressed properly for it, yes, you can. But we certainly don't expect anyone to do that. But you can watch and cheer us on.
Well, I want to make sure that our listeners understand the hours, and we'll post a link to your website as well today.
Wonderful.
when we post the archive of today's show, so that when folks go to listen to the archive of today's show, they can find the link. So your visitor hours are?
9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Tuesday through Saturday, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday, and then Monday we are closed. And so it's, you know, you can get a hold of us most anytime during the week. The phone rings in my house and the office just the same. But, you know, be creative with how you want to use the site, not only to come learn the history, but we have family reunions here. We have weddings and receptions here. We have, like I said, the school field trips. We have servant events here. We even have a small campground. If somebody wants to go camping, you can just stay here and spend the entire weekend here or however long it is that you enjoy camping. So there's multiple ways to use the site. We do baking lessons, and we can help people learn how to bake bread. And we do community baking days on the first Saturday of the month where we fire up the oven and let anybody who wants to bring something to bake use our oven to do their baking that day. So put together a group of people, come down, and we'll help you learn in the most interesting and creative way so that you can go home with a great experience and good memories and hopefully even a connection to your past. The one thing I really want to emphasize to people is that our site is located in Frona, but it belongs to everyone. Anyone who is a member of a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation, anyone who has German heritage, anyone who has roots to the immigration, this site is theirs. And we would like to see people make it their site by how they use the site. We're getting ready to actually expand and add on to our visitor center by enlarging our kitchen and adding some lobby space. And so help with that would be wonderful, either by volunteer services or monetary gifts.
Wonderful.
There's always something here for somebody to do in some way, and we welcome anybody who is interested to learn about it to come down.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks so much. I'm sorry we are out of time, but thank you for your time and sharing with us about Saxon
thank
Lutheran
you for
Memorial
asking.
Today.
This has been wonderful.
Wonderful. All right. Well, you can listeners, you can check it out when our archive is posted on the website. So check it out. Go to our website and look for the link to Saxon Lutheran Memorial today. Coming up later on this week, we'll continue our discussion on Reformation and Lutheran heritage. Be sure to listen tomorrow as we talk about resources.